Mini episode 377 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone. The FDH Lounge, mini episode number 377. Rick Morris and Jason Jones breaking it down for you, your FDH Lounge original dignitaries, as we've been doing all season long with Justified. Right after it goes off the air, we are getting into it. It's episode 4 of season 5. And Jason, I know you were settling in for a good one tonight. You texted me a picture before of your pregame meal, as it were. You started to make your little routine of settling in on a Tuesday night. And we've been talking a lot about character the last couple of weeks. Character developments with Boyd and Raylan in the absence of actions that were really going to drive the plot. I felt like tonight was a night that probably focused less on the character arcs and more on the action and the plots of season five as they're going to roll out.
Yeah. First off, let me just say, just like the bar scene between Gutterson, Raylan, and Boyd, I could just sit there and listen to you run your synopsis for the duration of our show here, but that probably wouldn't be as beneficial for everyone else. Anyway, it was a little different today, but you know what? Like so many other episodes, I'm perfectly fine and all right with what they did. There did seem to be a little bit more intensity and not so much development, if that makes sense, which... Like again, I think it works. We've seen 4 episodes now, and they're 4 very distinctly different episodes, all of which, in their own way, are sort of heading us down the path to what will eventually be the conclusion of this season. And I think they're doing it very artfully. I don't know.
They really are. It's very creative how it came together. And again, this is a night that really kind of struck me that again, we've been spending a lot of time the last couple of weeks in these breakdowns looking at events as they were affecting the character arcs and the journeys of Boyd and of Raylan. And tonight was a night of, again, I think less introspection as far as where they're going, a lot more action. You said it. The intensity was ramped up. It was the case. And it's so hard to even know where to begin on this. I will throw out there, I guess, where we ended last week. The whole Cousin Johnny set up there. We get to see the parlay at the jail. This show is very, very, very creative on where they set up the parlays. You have the great one in Bloody Harlan, which, for my money, is probably tied with Decoy as the greatest episodes of all time, the one where Mags Bennett and Boyd and the respective sides met at the church. Tonight, it's at the jail, and Ava is the third party in the meeting there with Boyd and Johnny. And it was very interesting because I couldn't quite tell. I want to know what you think. Was that a little bit of a callback to the end of last season when Johnny blurted out that he loved Ava, of him trying to use Ava to drive a wedge there with Boyd? Was Johnny, did he get the sense that he was realizing that Ava might be kind of souring of the way that things are going with Boyd? And whether or not he is actually in love with her, which we hadn't seen any signs of prior to that, but either he may be in love with her and seeing an opportunity or simply an opportunity to break them apart. What did you make of that moment?
Well, right out of the gate, my first thought was maybe he's just doing this because at that point in the show, we hadn't seen ZZ Top, whatever the heck his name is, that came up later. So on some level, I'm thinking he was really just taking advantage of a situation in order to wound Boyd and really have no other motivating factors beyond just hurting Boyd. However, sort of in retrospect, that still may be part of it. But now that you mentioned what happened last season, and it just seems like Johnny's one of those guys that the entire time just did what he was supposed to do while not really sharing much. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if he had feelings for Ava the entire time, maybe even as far back as dating before season one. So I don't know, but it definitely seems like there's something there. And how far it reaches, I don't think we're going to see just yet.
It was a night of hunting, of kind of fainting movements here and there with some of the different characters, a little bit of a game of human chess, because you had the scene set subsequently where Boyd was trying to track down Johnny and make a move on him, and that was all interrupted by Raylan and Tim coming into the bar and more or less taking over the surveillance, I guess you would say, of Boyd's movements. He didn't have freedom of movement to be able to pursue the Johnny angle until much, much, much later in the episode. So you had that going on that was very interesting. The revelation of Wade Messer as the confidential informant, and that seems to be tied in. They're not saying it in so many words, but Art's once again growing mistrust of Raylan, as faced by the developments that are coming out of Detroit and everything that is coming to light about Raylan's role in the death of Nikki Augustine, it's left unsaid, Jason, but clearly if Art trusted him a little bit more, then Raylan would have known about the Wade Messer angle probably from the jump.
Yeah, it felt like that little meeting in Art's office right after the break where Raylan is saying he's confused about some things, and you know, it basically all boils down to, and the fact that you didn't tell me until now. That sort of feels like a little bit of writing on the wall. Now, of course, you know, we're fans of the show and we watch the show and we're sort of interpreting as we go, and we may be reading too much into that, but from where we stand, it does seem to be a little strange. And then if you go back to, I want to say it was episode 2, the first time we see Art kind of digging from the tarmac situation, he seemed a little reluctant to pursue that angle. And then we see Art on the phone later being all too happy to entertain the tarmac situation. So there clearly seems to be something going on there, and I'm sure I'm not going to like where it's headed.
Yeah, I think you're not. I was kind of groaning on your behalf when I saw Art continuing to move in that direction tonight because, again, I know that. I'm not thrilled as somebody who is, not rooting to see that happen to Raylan, but you probably even more so than me, disturbed by that. So I could kind of feel it as that was flashing on the screen. What must be going through your head at that point in time? All of this developing while Dewey Crow, in the big development of the night, I think we can say, out there in the woods with Wade Messer, and I got to believe that a lot of people, maybe not everybody, but maybe there were a lot of people that were sucked in like I was by Dewey Crow, which I can't even believe I'm saying. I was fooled by Dewey Crow. I'll just put it out there. But I actually thought, because, again, Dewey's a real good-hearted kind of a guy, I thought his idea was to escape with Wade Messer. I really, really believed it at that point in time. And then it was kind of shocking that Dewey was going along with the program. It was always going to be an interesting balance to see how it went, how you keep Dewey sympathetic. And I think they did throughout that, despite the fact that he killed Messer, because, again, as he indicated afterwards, again, coerced into doing it by Daryl. And now Daryl has the leverage that he needs on Dewey. He's got him completely under his thumb. It's not just a matter of bullying the man. Again, Michael Rappaport in that character continuing to be very compelling. I've seen a lot of criticism online about the caliber of the accent that he's rocking here. So what were your thoughts on this here tonight? Anything that you want to talk about with the Crow family, whether it be Dewey and what he ended up having to do there, Daryl coercing him into it, the iffiness of the accent? taken away on wherever you think is most relevant.
Well, I'm right with you on the Dewey Crow thing. The second they come back from commercial and you see them together, I thought this was a flashback or something strange is going on. And then the idea that they were just going to dig up whatever that was and then just, you know, hit it and never look back, I thought made perfect sense, and I got sucked in the same way. And then, of course, when you realize that's not happening, you go, oh, wow, I can't believe they sucked me in on that one. So there's that. I still think that there's an issue with Dewey where either he continues to be the bumbling idiot that he is, screwing things up, or he's going to go down a certain path so far that there's no turning back and he ends up being a bad guy, no matter how much they want to endear him to us. So that's interesting. I do think that all of this is going to sort of come to a head by the end of the season, and that the Crow family situation is not going to be long-term beyond this season. They're just...
Absolutely.
They're just facing off too hard and too heavy and too fast at, you know, specifically in the scene with the Marshals and Kendall. There was a whole situation there that I just thought... You really don't want to have a standoff at Audrey's with the U.S. Marshals. So I don't know really where that's headed, but clearly I don't think it's going to last much past this season. And what happens will sort of dictate Dewey Crow going forward. I like how they keep introducing new crows. You know, first episode, of course, it was we the patriarch of the Crow family, and then we saw the sister as the lawyer, and now we're seeing Danny Crow, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like they're introducing a new crow each week, which is interesting. The accent is, you know, it's not terrible because it sounds like what, and pardon the generalization, but it sounds like what the countryside of Florida sounds like.
Okay.
If we're talking about the same thing there. It's not like the Crows have lived in Kentucky their whole lives. You know, Dewey has, and it's evident there. But the rest of the family is sort of an amalgamation of other things. And then you've got, you know, LaCroix there, whatever that guy's name is that I mentioned last week, the guy in the hat, the alligator hunter guy that doesn't seem to say much, and he's straight up, you know, Louisiana French. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of mess going on with the accents, which I don't think will play a whole big role into the thing. But I think Rappaport's doing a decent job playing the character being almost the exact opposite of Dewey Crow, which in itself is going to create a sort of cluster F train wreck situation at some point.
I believe that to be the case as well. I have to say, in watching the replay here silently as we're doing this, it's coming right up to the Dewey Crow prayer part, which I definitely have to touch on. But one more quick note on Rappaport. I had forgotten before I asked about the accent thing there that, again, you have been somebody who has been and lived in an awful lot of places. I had forgotten that you had lived in an area, a metro area, somewhat adjacent to the Everglades down there in Florida, so you would know about these kind of accents. I had forgotten that when I asked you the question, but yeah, that was a nice touch that you got there in terms of vouching.
Not 100% of the population are snowbirds from, you know, the northeastern part of the country that have just moved to Florida and have a non-regional diction. there are some people that have sort of a localized sound to them, and I'm not going to say it's authentic because it's not, but it's, you know, you can sell it at least.
Absolutely, yeah. Well played. I had forgotten that you had that kind of knowledge specifically of that. But, yeah, to go back to the Dewey Crow prayer thing there, as soon as I saw he was starting to pray, I was like, this is going to be comedy gold. This is going to be some of the best of Dewey Crow. And only Dewey could manage to work into a prayer in his completely stupid, in his completely lunatic, but innocent kind of a way here. talking about making promises to God about what he's going to do after God lets him finish the job of killing Wade Messer. And it was just one of those moments where I'm sure you had the same sense I did. I mean, as soon as he started going, as soon as you saw what it was, you knew that it was going to be definitely the funniest moment of the night and probably one of the funniest of the entire season.
Well, let's back up a second, because you don't have to be a devout or even educated religious person to go, wait a minute, are you asking for God's assistance to murder someone? I'm pretty sure that's not how it works. So there was that, you know, and then as you're trying to wrap your head around that part and think, well, it's Dewey and whatnot, you stop and your brain goes, wait, did he just promise to go to Sunday school?
The writing for the Dewey Crow character is just incredible. Yeah, there were just all these things. I mean, the brain was just kind of processing one thing, and then another thing would happen in the course of that monologue.
But yeah, that was when he fell to his knees. Actually, my first thought was, he's not losing blood or anything, so why is he acting like he can't go on? And then I realized, oh, this was his lame attempt to start a prayer that was going to be comical at best.
Yeah, and ultimately it proved to be a moment of high comedy amidst the drama of what was, you know, a life and death situation. I mean, you're talking about two of the biggest nitwit buffoon characters on the show here. I guess maybe it's not nice for me to speak ill of the recently deceased here, Wade Messer, but yeah, Wade Messer, Dewey Crow.
No, go ahead.
I mean, you know, bottom five on the entire show, right? I don't know that we could think of four people through the course of the show that are more consistently stupid than them. So it was really this show doing what it does at its very best, working in the drama, working in the black humor, and to an extent, I think that ties, not to be too cute on the segue here, but that bar scene with Tim and Raylan when they went to go talk to Boyd, and from the whole thing about the reference to Colton Rhodes, and we have a friend in common. I don't think he would necessarily refer to me as a friend. Just everything in the back and forth there. Again, for all the things that you've praised about this show and some of the character things and everything like that, I have to think that moment in the bar, Tim, Raylan, and Boyd was probably one of your favorite of the season to date.
Hey, clearly. I mean, I almost have to divide the scenes or the parts that I really, really enjoy from critical to the telling of the story in fact and plot and all that, and then just scenes that I just really enjoy, whether they're important or not. And one of the other ones was when Boyd is in the back stairwell at the hospital with the Undertaker's girlfriend,
yeah.
Lady. I mean, that was one of those scenes where linguistically it was like, it was like a dance meets a painting in process. It was so amazing to watch unfold. And this was the same thing. It was, you know, Raylan walks in right as Boyd is saying, don't let him out of your sight, hangs up. And in Boyd's mind, his concern is that they don't need to know what that phone call was about. And what he does realize is he's holding a shotgun in the other hand, which then,
yeah,
you know, starts the whole thing. Raylan, you know, says, are you familiar with Mr. Gutterson here or whatever? And then they keep going. And then it's this nice back and forth sort of dance of some sort where it's almost like they are trying to one-up each other, and by doing so create this beautiful thing that happens. And for a couple minutes, I actually forgot to care about the details of what's happening because that scene was just so masterful. And luckily, I have some sort of a knack for this. But as in last week, that happened to be the scene where my wife was in the room experiencing it. So, once again, another week in a row of, you know, really making sure that the right parts are being seen so that we can convert the heathens.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, anybody that gets a little taste of seeing the three of them on screen together. And, again, you know, from a female perspective as well, I'm sure it doesn't hurt that none of the three guys that we're talking about here are reputed to be very hard on the female eyes. So that's another thing that probably lures in some of the unconverted as well. But, you know, it's just a masterful scene there with the three of them. First time that they were on canvas together this year. And it's one of these things where, you know, it's always a couple episodes into the season, right? It's never like right off the bat that Raylan and Boyd are in one another's orbits. It always takes a little bit of time here. And previously in those scenes, you've always had Arlo in there. In seasons three and season four, you've had that as kind of like the common element. And again, not to go too heavy on the symbolism, but it almost felt like, and the writers didn't know this was going to happen, that Elmore Leonard was going to pass away between seasons four and five. But the fact that Raylan and Boyd don't have that connection anymore, it almost felt like it was kind of fitting that it took something else to kind of bring them together and put them in that scene tonight, because it is really kind of uncharted waters without Elmore Leonard. They used to run these things past them as much as possible, and this was the first scene that we've ever seen tonight between Raylan and Boyd that hadn't passed by the eyes of Elmore Leonard prior to it being the case here. And we've talked about this before. We can see the end in sight with the show as much as we don't want to. It's the penultimate season. The arcs are setting up slowly for the beginning of the end of the show. So this meeting with them tonight, maybe I'm making too much of it, but it felt a little bit different without Elmore Leonard being in the background. And it was kind of fitting, I thought, the way that it played out. And I really thought they did justice to the past Raylan and Boyd path crossings.
Let me say that I think you and I have arrived at the same conclusion from that, even if we approached it differently. And as I'm watching this and how beautiful it was, and again, just as a comparative reference to anybody that isn't familiar with this show yet, but maybe something else, I am a huge West Wing degenerate, and there are times in that show where the language is ramped up a little bit, and it's almost like you feel like they're trying to impress somebody. Like, it's gone beyond its normal song and dance to who are you trying to impress? And I think that I felt that that's what was happening tonight, was that, and maybe it has something to do with the fact that Leonard Elmore is not giving the final green light on these things, and almost as if this was one of those moments that they would have put it past them to say, hey, what do you think? How do we go with this? Is this right? Is it wrong? And it almost feels like maybe they felt that because they couldn't do that, they had to step it up a little bit because it did feel different. But ultimately, by the end, after you've seen that, the end of the scene, you know, it works. It absolutely does a thing with the relationships between the two since the last time they had conversed together on screen at the same time. But I just thought maybe it had maybe they were trying a little too hard to make a moment out of it because they didn't have the sage wisdom of the creator to say yes or no.
That's very interesting that we both had the same thought there. Again, like you said, even if it was in different ways about Elmore Leonard, the author who had created these characters in his short stories here, and the guy who's been the showrunner from day one, Graham Yost and other executive producers like Timothy Oliphant, yeah, I thought really kind of banding together really to do a strong job all season long. But, yeah, in that scene tonight, that's just interesting you and I had that in the back of our minds, because it's always epic. The first meeting of Raylan and Boyd during a season, and as you start to see where the arcs are setting up for the rest of the way. You know, we saw that, and even some of the characters that were not on screen tonight, whether it be a minor one like Picker, whether it be a more major one like Boyd's relatively new crime partner, Wynn Duffy, they were alluded to. Art found out when he had his meeting with Canadian crime boss Will Sasso in prison there that Picker was down in Kentucky. And so the trail is going to lead down there. And again, we can start to see now everything almost sort of, I'll just use the term converging in on itself, basically, all these threads, because that's kind of where I see it all going now. It's going to be this messy, beautiful tableau. You got the crows here, and we'll see how they tie in even more to the stuff there, but it's pretty easy to see how the Raylan and Boyd stuff is going to continue to overlap here, particularly as Art starts following the trail it's going to be very, very interesting to see all of these things feeding in on one another, and it really gives, I think, season five a different feel than any of the ones we've seen previously. Yeah, Daryl might be the closest we've seen to a big bad for this season, but it's all these plot twists that are kind of tying in on one another in what just looks like a beautiful kind of, you know, it's hard for me to describe, but you know, it's almost like creative destruction as far as how they're all going to tie in and one thing's going to affect another. And, you know, how are you seeing, what's the sense that you're getting four episodes in on how it's setting the pace for the rest of the season?
Well, clearly we've hit on the idea that it seems that they're taking a different approach in the storytelling, which is perfectly fine. You know, some of the better novels that I've read, and I'm not a big reader, so let's not put a lot of stock in that, do this thing where you're following one storyline for a while, and then, you know, you turn the page, and then next thing you know, it's been a few chapters before you've revisited that thing. And it seems to be very similar, kind of a deal where we're doing one thing, then another, but not every episode you're going to get everything, which I think is great. But what happens is, I think, we're going to see all these storylines sort of all focusing in on the same center, all directed in the same place ultimately, so that by season's end they sort of all converge together. But I think that as we go along, we're going to get to a point where the distance between these are going to become less and less and less, almost to the point where it wouldn't surprise me one bit if one or two of these storylines almost intersected before the convergence, if that makes any sense. You know, how does Boyd and Johnny affect the Canadians and Picker? How does that translate to Ava's situation and the character, the Undertaker, and so on? So it's very interesting. And I almost kind of sit back. Like we talked about last week, you asked if I wanted you to tell me what you thought was going to happen last week, and I said no. And it's the same thing. I'm kind of sitting back, like, completely blind to it. I'm not even trying to figure it out. I'm just sitting back, soaking it in, taking it as it comes, because I'm almost afraid that if I try to figure it out, I'll take away from what they're doing. So it absolutely feels like everything's going to come down on each other. It's just a matter of, does everything hit at once, or are things going to start, you know, falling into each other like an asteroid storm? So I don't know what the answer is, but either way, I'm probably going to be blown away when it happens.
Yeah, and for anybody particularly that caught the beginning of last week, a great decision on your part not to get clued in on any speculation by me. Again, I had a strong sense it was going to be Johnny Crowder, but I didn't know for sure. But I could have clued you in on that, but it was so much better to let you see it in real time. For something like this where I don't have any knowledge whatsoever on this, and neither do you, let's go to where you left it there as far as how this plays out. My guess would be, 9 episodes to go in the season, that it's more or less like, for lack of a better term, exploding dominoes. Say maybe the Johnny and Boyd thing comes to the surface next week, and that kind of resolves itself, but then there ends up being some collateral, not exactly damage, or maybe damage, but some collateral effects on another part of the whole tableau here, and that the last 9 episodes are basically like a string of, you know, M80s going off one after another, would be my guess, as opposed to a build of all of them kind of, you know, moving at a certain pace, and then in the last 3 or 4 episodes all blowing up together in a cluster bomb. So my guess is on more sequential. Let's just put it on the record here. Are you getting the sense that that might be the case, or do you think we're building to like a 3 or 4 episode cluster bomb at the end?
Well, 2 hours ago I would have said I thought we were all building to one big epic finale, you know, that just absolutely ties everything together in one of the better episodes we would have ever seen. But as each storyline has developed, it seems to like divide and branch out into other ways. which tells him that it almost seems like there's no way possible that all of it could get pushed to the end. So I think you might be onto something with the idea that some of these storylines are going to work themselves out or slim themselves into smaller storylines, which are more manageable. For instance, if we just use the Boyd and Johnny situation, whatever happens there might end up bringing a couple storylines together. Does not Johnny just go away? Does Boyd just go away? Does Ava, you know, rekindle her affection for Boyd and they're all happy again and we don't have to worry about the fallout from that? Does she go more in the Johnny direction? And while I'm on that point, just so we don't run out of time, the scene in the prison where the one guard tries to assert himself on Ava, and even yeah. I thought was a terrible mistake. I didn't have any reason to know why that was. I just knew that it was. And then the other guard, the female guard, lets it be known that Ava is protected. Now, my question to you is, the natural thought process would be that she's protected by Boyd. But what if, for some strange reason, while Boyd is preoccupied with his business endeavors, Johnny slid in the back door, so to speak, to make sure that Ava's all right? Or am I
That's
just
a great thought.
Thinking too
no,
hard?
No, no, no. You may have something there because, again, what I would be thinking is, it's been established previously that the Dixie Mafia has its tentacles in prison. If you remember, the guy that Arlo killed last year, that he shivved, was a Dixie Mafia hitman. That momentarily caused a little bit of strife between Wynn and between Boyd at the time there. But, yeah, no, I mean, if Johnny is tied in now with Hot Rod Dunham, which we know to be the case, who's to say that guy doesn't have connections inside? So that's excellent. And that,
because
if I see this anywhere online, if I see anybody speculating about this, I'll have to go register to be a blog commenter on wherever that turns up and say, my senior editor called that first. You are first on record with that, Jason. That's your call.
Well, and here's the funny thing is, you know, we're kind of like working through this episode, and at first we're thinking, well, maybe, you know, X, Y, and Z happen. And that Johnny showing up the way he did, you know, and saying that he was there for Ava maybe doesn't mean much, but maybe it does. And then as we go along, we go, well, wait a minute. If he's gone through the trouble to put in the legwork, pun intended, for him to come in and essentially basically step in and show Ava he's going to do what Boyd's not because he actually cares for her first and not second, that could make this whole Johnny, Boyd, Ava situation massively problematic. It could take it away from being a third or fourth level plot line to maybe a second level plot line, which would be insane. Because I think all of us, whether you want to admit it or not, that are watching this are trying to convince ourselves that, oh, Ava and Boyd will be fine. Everything will be fine with that eventually. But if you allow yourself to pause a second and try to realize what it would do to the whole scenario if Ava leaves Boyd for Johnny, then it's a whole new ball of wax.
Massive uncharted territory. The one thing I wanted to get to tonight that I wanted to make sure of, and I think we have at least a moment here in our remaining time, is with Boyd Crowder and with the character of him, it's very interesting. The actor who has probably been on the FX networks the longest period of time for any series combined now between Justified and S.H.I.E.L.D., Walt Goggins, I have finally in the last week gotten a chance to check him out on the S.H.I.E.L.D. Had never seen it previously, but I'm already about 20 episodes in, which is a combination of multitasking, extreme crappy weather, et cetera. It's very amenable to binge viewing, certainly this time of year, and Hulu Plus has allowed me to do that. I've enjoyed it. I feel like it's a TV snobs-worthy show. It's not Justified, it's not Breaking Bad, but I think it's really good. What's very interesting to me is the character of Shane that he inhabits in there. I want to say first and foremost, this is very unfair what I'm about to say to Shane Ryan, the creator of the show, and everyone else on there, but it's a real come-down to see him in that role. It would be a come-down to see Walt Goggins in probably any role but Boyd Crowder, because this is his masterpiece. You said, I believe it was last week, one of the great characters in the recent history of TV, but I've alluded to this, that the Boyd Crowder of the pilot, Boyd version 1.0, as we might call him, that anarchic energy that he had, the joyousness in shooting that rocket launcher and pursuing his life of crime, whatever. I'll tell you what, Shane as the dirty cop, it's the same energy. And I keep going back to this. We talked about this previously on the show. We talked about it. I know I mentioned it with Tim Oliphant, that he's got the same kind of energy in this role that he did as Seth Bullock on Deadwood, playing that kind of lawman who, you know, has a little bit of a troubled side but is a good guy fundamentally. And Nate Noy, our FPH director of research, had mentioned previously, because he is a Malcolm in the Middle completist, having seen Bryan Cranston on there, and that's where they started Walt White, that Walt White started with some of that same kind of Hal type of character in the pilot episode. I think it was a little bit darker than that because Hal was, you know, somebody who was fairly happy-go-lucky about his lot in life versus Walter White, who was not. But it's very interesting, Jason, of where these shows will kind of take an actor like this and start with where you identify them in another role before they take them in another direction. I don't know if it's intentional, but it keeps happening time and time again. And like I said, the Boyd of the pilot and Shane from The Shield, I see some real similarities there. It's just on the surface, as far as that bad boy kind of manic energy that they brought to the parts.
You know, I may be a little bit of a snob when it comes to where I feel sitcoms belong in the greater landscape of today's television, but I really don't think that Goggins from S.H.I.E.L.D. to Justified is the same as the guy from Malcolm in the Middle to Walter White, but that's a whole conversation for a whole other day.
Okay.
The one thing I will say is very interesting. If you want to sort of cleanse your palate on Walter Goggins' characters,
mm-hmm.
what you should do is watch S.H.I.E.L.D., then go and watch Major League 3 Back to the Minors, then watch Justified, and I guarantee you, you'll feel much better once you're watching Justified. But no, I agree with your depiction of it, is that the Boyd Crowder character, and hopefully it's one of those things that in hindsight later on, when the series is over, you know, and you've got these people that sort of wait for series to run their course before they go out and they binge watch the whole thing, maybe,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hoping that eventually he'll get a little bit more credit for the Boyd character, because let's face it, Walter White, and I would even say, depending on what the rest of his career looks like, you know, Aaron Paul's depiction of Jesse is vastly underrated. You have these characters like that. You can even talk about what's-his-face from Mad Men. It may not be a range-inspiring character, but it is an all-time character. And we can go around the, you know, around the block, so to speak, on a lot of these great shows and point out that Boyd Crowder is one of those characters. And it's the funny thing is I actually don't like to mix the people that I really like in other things. I mentioned to you off air that the new Crow is a character. The new Danny Crow is a very serious, very believable character in Justified. But the last
right.
thing I saw him in is absolutely a ridiculous, silly, you would be ashamed of yourself to play this sort of character from Supernatural.
More commonality there. We've bumped up sure. against the end of time here, Jason, but great discussion as always. Really look forward to next week, my man. It keeps getting better every week.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.